Imagine the scene. Students from a public school located on the south side of Chicago disembark from their bus in front of a stunning $65 million educational facility located in the suburbs. One African-American student exclaims, "This school is way better than I thought it would be." She says this before even entering the school to tour the Olympic-sized pool and other world-class athletic facilities, walk the well-lit hallways, and attend several classes. Until this day, having no concrete comparison with which to measure the education she's receiving in her school on Chicago's South Side, this young lady has not been able to really fathom or comprehend the short shrift she receives in her education. Her statement succinctly reveals the importance of the concept of relative deprivation, that is, the way people compare their plight with similarly situated others. Unequal City builds a crucial case for why social scientists, politicians, policymakers, teachers, and parents should focus on the home and schooled contexts of youth to understand how their perceptions of inequality are shaped by their racially divergent worlds and their interactions with authority figures within and across those social spaces. Each day, Chicago residents navigate streets and neighborhoods that are still strictly demarcated by the identities of their inhabitants. Adolescents will have to traverse social and physical terrain that powerfully shapes their immediate and long-term perceptions and experiences. As I will show, the passage from home to school each day embodies the curious predicament of the urban American teenager, who will learn as much, if not much more, about his or her identity, social inequality, and the workings of the larger social structure of authority during these journeys, as he or she will at school. This is especially the case for tens of thousands of students who travel more than 2 miles to attend high school. Chapter 2 chronicles the perpetually changing educational landscape in Chicago, whose educational and residential policies, instead of shoring up schools as formative social institutions that can create and maintain social solidarity, have often wrought instability and conflict. When social cohesion is interrupted, danger can arise. A Chicago teenager's daily routine of traveling to school can be a theater of both sociability and violence. Day in and day out, students must work to avoid danger from peers and neighbors, as well as the police meant to protect them. Safe passage between places, just like the broader passage from adolescence to adulthood, is not a uniform experience for all young people. This is abundantly clear in American cities. So how do urban adolescents navigate the passage between home and school? What do they think about their experiences? In Chapter 2, I use 4 students' journeys to their schools to answer these questions through the lens of geographies of inequality. Their perceptions of safety further restrict or expand their visions of the city and inform how they navigate within and across its various physical and social borders. Chapter 3 takes a closer look at Chicago, a city of neighborhoods, in which a major anchor of the community, the neighborhood school, has been displaced. The racial-spatial divide in the United States, according to sociologists Ruth Peterson and Lauren Crivo, is characterized by a social arrangement in which substantial ethno-racial inequality in social and economic circumstances and power in society is combined with segregated and unequal residential locations across racial and ethnic groups. The racial-spatial divide is a significant structural mechanism that captures the array of resources, opportunities, and diversity available to young people, and also shapes their ability to perceive, experience, and adapt to discriminatory treatment in education, employment, and housing. This chapter's examination of the school as a central organizing social institution lays the foundation for the analyses that follow, demonstrating how teens who daily cross race, class, neighborhood, or gang lines to attend school have an expanded frame for understanding social and structural hierarchies, and how this frame affects their view of themselves and their prospects for mobility. Chapter 4 investigates the claim that contemporary urban youth are increasingly exposed to police contact and at earlier ages than urban youth in the past. Owing to the implementation of the surveillance practices and disciplinary policies of an overtly carceral institution and its accompanying carceral apparatus. Schools are extensively free, but have come to resemble correctional facilities. Metal detectors, surveillance cameras, and other mechanisms designed to monitor and control inhabitants are now standard equipment. Youth who must navigate these spaces risk police contact, and their response to these penalizing routines and rituals within their educational institutions varies depending on their safety concerns and their relationships with the enforcers of the law. The descriptions of four types of Chicago school environments earlier in this chapter reveal some of the prison-like practices endorsed by our education system, even when safety threats are improbable. Everyday students encounter pat-downs and are monitored on live video surveillance cameras by police officers. Chapter 4 also broadly examines the criminalization of adolescents, revealing who it is students believe police are there to serve and protect, and detailing their ambivalence about the presence and purpose of the police and security guards patrolling their hallways and classrooms. If teens have been deemed criminal or suspicious and made subject to police searches while walking to school, have they already left adolescence and entered into some netherworld of adulthood? Through this example and countless others, young people are often introduced to the criminal justice system without setting foot in a jail or a courtroom. Chapter 5 explores how these personal and vicarious encounters with justice and injustice, usually experienced as students travel from their neighborhoods to their schools and back home again, shape their attitudes toward authorities. When young people are formally stopped, searched, and sometimes arrested, or when they know someone else who's had that experience, they develop well-formed opinions about the prejudices and practices of the police with whom they interact, regardless of their visceral responses to the experience. Many of the youth surveyed and interviewed for this work express feelings of powerlessness and an understanding of inequality that originated in one or more of the essential components of identity: age, race, gender, and class. Each of these categories can be a marker of power or its opposite. These young people often experience the latter, powerlessness, in at least one, if not all, of these categories. These components of identity and the relative power or powerlessness deriving from each shape these teens' beliefs about their opportunities for mobility, from finding a good job to living in a nice house to driving a fancy car. For these young people, as it is for all of us, their visions of the future were shaped to a great extent by their experiences in the present. As we shall see, the sense of social mobility they would have as adults was influenced by their physical mobility as teenagers. Chances are that most of the people reading this book were not stopped by a police officer when they were a teenager, nor were they frisked or brought in for questioning. Most of us think of the police, when we think of them at all, as a benign force on the periphery of our lives that serves to protect us when we call them. For many urban young people, however, especially males of color, police play a much more aggressive and proactive role in their lives. Many of these young people routinely have contact with the justice system, and I join the call of criminologists to policymakers to take note of the uneven impacts of the justice system. The justice system's impact is concentrated squarely on young males of color, particularly those who are identified as African-American or Hispanic. One aim of this research is to learn how their hopes and dreams have been affected by the opportunity structure made available to them in our purportedly democratic society. What we shall see is that schools, which should be an equalizing force in American society, are instead more likely to reproduce existing social stratification by race, gender, class, and neighborhood. Schools are essentially institutionalized spaces in which structures of power recreate themselves. They are also social sites where the ultimate objective is to shape the formation of students' knowledge of self, community, nation, and world. Thus, we must confront crucial questions. What exactly are young people learning in school? Not just about math and science, but also about their own importance and the relative worth of their peers. What signals are they receiving about what the future holds? Let us begin to explore the minds of marginalized minors by delving into the realities of their worlds. As we learn a bit more about life in Chicago and about the wide variety within and across young people's school and home environments, we will see how their sense of racial hierarchies is constructed and how their adolescent visions compare to our understandings of ourselves and of our fellow adults. The perspectives of these young people and their horizon of expectations, which are so often ignored, give us a moving and at times disturbing look into our future. We will see that their beliefs and understandings are both stratified by their race and rooted in their place. The potent mix of these forces has a lot to tell us about ourselves and about the world we create each day for our youth.